Once more under the breach, dear friend.
Let's close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting second hour of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And the telephone number in here is 254-773-1400. I wanted to talk a little bit about an effect on your 401k that you might be aware of, or may not. It's kind of hard to quantify this, except to look at the large numbers and look what's happened in the past. Meanwhile, though, we do have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, this is John calling from Belton. I've got a question about the how China was getting around some of the limits of steel, the steel quantity they could sell to the United States by selling to other countries, going through other countries that don't even produce steel,
right,
that would turn that steel around and sell it to the United States. Now listen.
Okay. Thank you.
The two countries namely involved there were Vietnam and Thailand. Both of those countries, this is before the tariffs, were warned about it because it was a way of, I like this word, obfuscating where the stuff was coming from. The whole made in China or exported from a given location is there so that we know how to measure what's going on in the trade world. So after the tariffs hit, Vietnam had a big fine given to it at the governmental level, as well as the country, the companies involved, as well as Thailand. This is something. And I want to hand this back to you because you were in the middle of something right before the caller came in. This is something important to understand. Of the about 23% of our imported goods from China, I'm sorry, of our imported steel, it's not from China. So of that 23%, if you say 23% are imports, so let's look at imports as a whole on steel. Only between 1 and 2% of that whole, of that 100% of imports on steel, came from China.
Which is equivalent to about 0.25% of our total imports,
yeah,
of steel in the United States.
Of
our total steel in the United States, about 0.25% to 0.5% of the total steel in the United States comes from China.
Now,
or did come from China.
Let's be clear on something else. China, in its effort to boost itself out of the recession, spent a lot of money on infrastructure. They spent huge amounts of money building cities with nobody to live in them, and roads and bridges, massive amounts. In order to do that, at the beginning, steel prices went way up because they were buying steel from the United States, and we didn't have enough to go around already. They were buying steel from Germany. They didn't have enough to go around already. So they established a whole series of steel production facilities using the best and newest technology.
Who did? Who's the they?
The Chinese did. The Chinese did on their own soil. They said, we're going to do this. They started importing iron from Africa, which is one of the places that we get a lot of our iron from as well. So imported the iron. Was importing scrap metal from the United States. It's something we've been selling them, our scrap aluminum and scrap steel and our scrap plastic and our scrap paper, for decades. They started producing not enough steel to deal with their own expansion. So they kept increasing the amount of steel they produced every year. This is the same thing that took place in our Industrial Revolution at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century. Think Carnegie. So they built up their steel manufacturing, and then their building stopped. They started laying off on the bridge building and on the building and on the new cities popping up out of nowhere. The economy was doing well enough that the government didn't need to do ghost projects. But they still had all this steel production. So they started selling the steel to the rest of the world, which started diluting the steel and made steel prices drop drastically across the world. Now, it costs a lot of money for the Chinese to ship steel to the United States, so we're not their biggest, by any stretch, importer of steel. A lot of the big skyrises used Chinese steel. That's one of the major focus points of imported steel from China. A clear statement here is that the Trump organization was one of those people doing it. And of course he did. He was taking advantage of his cheap steel. So this is kind of an about face, but not one we didn't expect.
Several people have asked me, what would I do about the intellectual property issues and the fact that we don't have enough steel mills in the United States? Well, the Chinese actually have set a pretty good example.
So did we. So did we 100 years ago.
But what we all we needed to do is say strategically, and by the way, I would have supported this had the president done it. Strategically, we don't make enough steel in the United States to support ourselves in time of war. Now, that, by the way, under the World Trade Organization, is a perfectly legitimate claim. And because of that, we're going to give tax credits, just like we do for building wind farms.
Or solar panels.
Or solar panels. We will give tax credits for building and operating steel mills.
A new steel mill coming in is going to get a bunch of tax
mm-hmm.
credits.
And that would cause people to build steel mills in the United States where we could, and operate steel mills in the United States where we could become more self-sufficient in steel. And if we wanted to do that, it'd be fine. But imposing, for example, a 25% tariff on steel imported from Canada, which is our biggest source of imported steel.
About 17% of our imported steel comes from there, which makes it about 5% of the steel that we use.
And then saying it's for strategic reasons because we want to be able to defend ourselves against Canada. That's beyond questionable. That's silly.
Yeah, it is silly.
And it simply raises the cost of products made. And this is going to take a while to filter through the system. It raises the cost of manufacturing in the United States, and that's where we're going to see it. But let's talk about the S&P 500,
yes.
If I could, for
you, you were pregnant with thought, and then we changed your labor and said, no, labor on something else for a moment.
The larger a company is in the United States and the more industrialized it is, which means it's going to be the top among the top 20, top 50 companies in the S&P 500, which, by the way, occupy about 50% of the valuation, the more likely they are to have supply chains that extend and to do many international deals and international selling. In other words, the larger the company is in the United States in the S&P 500, the more likely it is to depend on international free trade or near free trade for its profitability. Now, what does that mean? That means that the weight of the companies that are likely to be most directly impacted by tariffs and counter tariffs occupy the majority of the S&P 500. Now, when the market comes down in the S&P 500 or the Dow Jones Industrial Average, does that mean that the rest of the market comes down too? Not necessarily, because there are smaller positions. As a matter of fact, we're already seeing that happen. The S&P 500 is basically flat for the year, but what we're seeing is the smaller and mid-cap stocks doing better than the S&P 500. Now, that over the long term, that's normal, but in this circumstances, with 20% growth year over year in the S&P 500 earnings, one would assume that the S&P 500 would be taking off like gangbusters. But the reason it hasn't, and this is anecdotal, we don't have any solid evidence sitting out there anywhere, but it's becoming more and more apparent that traders and investors and institutional investors are becoming concerned that larger industrialized stocks will be the ones that take the biggest hits if, and this is why we haven't seen a market crash or anything, if the threats of the tariffs, which start climbing up towards $1 trillion before very long, by the way. You know, you start with $34 billion and then $16 billion and then $24 billion and then another $200 billion. It doesn't take a real long time before our side of the tariff wars hit $1 trillion. And if the other side of the tariff war comes in with an equal, if we hit $500 billion, for example, and the other side of the tariff war, the reciprocal tariffs on U.S. cars and U.S. everythings hit another $500 billion. Now we got $1 trillion worth of goods and services that are being taxed higher than everything else because of tariffs.
And if we look at that closely, here's some important stuff. This is part of the reason why we're not seeing a rise in the market. If we say roughly $1 trillion worth of our goods and combined goods that are being traded somehow bought or sold in the United States are being tariffed at 20%, that means the price of those things are going to go up more like 30% on average. Some of those are going to go up 40%. Some of them are going to go down, go up just a little bit more than the 20%. Well, if you look at that, that's about $300 billion of loss to the economy. And that's why we can put a rough estimate on how much we expect the GDP to be affected by it. If you take $300 billion out of the GDP, it affects it by 0.1 or 0.2%. And when we're talking about GDP growth somewhere between 2 and 4%, each 0.1 or 0.2% is important. We got a boost of about that much from the tax cut. So this is, in effect, a different tax to replace the one we just cut. The government revenue on this stuff should go up, and I'm waiting to see the numbers on this because most of the stuff is just getting inputs. Most of the stuff is just going into place. But I want to wait and see what the governmental numbers are on this, on what the revenue is from tariffs. Tariffs are traditionally a pretty minor part of our revenue. But when we're putting tariffs on hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars of goods, that's going to have an impact on what Congress can spend. So what we're seeing is that the taxes were cut for you on income, for me on income, but new taxes are going into place on the things that we buy. In effect, this is becoming a consumption tax. And if it was done in a uniform and understood method, I might actually like it as a change from the income tax. But when it's being implemented in more chaotic manner than the existing tax code, that's a problem. Would you agree with that? The complexity of doing trade now has just gone through the stratosphere.
Yeah, and
it's just difficult to figure out what company, what country you should trade with for a given product.
Yes, I guess is a short answer.
Right. So if we could do it in a uniform manner and say, hey, countries are going to use this as a, in essence, a sales tax, it may be better than an income tax if it were simplified. I would prefer them just, let's simplify the tariffs. Let's simplify the tax codes. If businesses know what they can expect to pay, it makes businesses be able to prosper and grow. The uncertainty is the issue. And this is when we talk about recession. It isn't about tariffs. It isn't about the bottlenecks. It's about certainty. If you know that you can get the parts you need at the price that you expect and the labor that you need at the price that you can expect, then you can expand and have a pretty good idea what your profitability is going to be before you spend the money. If you don't have that certainty, it makes spending the money a lot more difficult. That means that we get less business expansion. That's the reality that we're talking about here. Long term, if we come out of this trade war with a lot of concessions from the rest of the world and we go back to no tariffs, we may benefit from this really long term. Short term, nobody really benefits from this. So I think that's it for me. I want to switch to the housing market, if that's all right.
All right, go ahead.
Market Watch, the economy and politics, though this is more economy than politics. This came out, this is Andrea Riquier. Sales of previously owned homes are slumping. It's the second month in a row that we've had declining sales of previously owned homes. It's not just 2 months in a row, though. It's 2 months in a row of months that are traditionally months that go up. We're going into summer. People tend to want to buy houses going into summer and during summer, not buy them. This is the time when it happens. And we're seeing a slump right now that is an example of several things. There are new houses being built at a higher rate than they have been built in a very long time, more than a decade. So if you have the choice between a house that on average, an existing house is more than 10 years old, or a new house, which one are you going to choose? Well, some people are going to choose the existing house, but some people, more people, are going to choose a new house if it's available. Well, that means that as the new houses are selling more, the old houses are selling less. We're seeing a slump there. That's important to know, because what that means is that just like in the labor area, we may have gotten to the top of the peak or very close to it by saying housing prices have been going up and going up and going up. We may have run out of the demand to make them keep going up. I expect prices to keep going up for another 6 months at least before people realize, because generally they use last year's numbers to make their house pricing.
On another subject, gold. You know, gold is kind of like Bitcoin.
Only you can hold it.
Yes. The thing about gold, at least has some practical use. And you can actually buy it and store it someplace and see it and say, yeah, that's there, that's gold.
Bitcoin, and it's pretty.
In Bitcoin, you can't do that with.
And I've spent some time panning for it in Canada and in Colorado. It's kind of fun to do when you find it.
Well, one of the interesting things about gold at this point is that gold has dropped in value over the last 90 days. Now, you would think that that would not be what we've got is the market has declined in value during that time period. The last, you know, since the end of January when the trade war announcements started coming out. And we would historically, back in the good old days that may or may not have actually been real, when the market started down because of some type of international uncertainty or some type of tension or the potential for war, the potential for trade war, gold would start up because people in the United States particularly would buy it.
One flip side of that as well is it's used by a lot of people, though the numbers don't back it up, as an inflation hedge. Well, we're starting to see inflation, but the price of gold is going down.
Yeah. And since the first quarter, gold is down 6.5%.
We're having just over a 2% inflation rate. That means that it's down about 8%.
Well, it's only down for 3 months at that, so it wasn't 2% in the quarter.
No, you're right.
So it's down around something like 7% in real terms. Now, why? And we've been talking about this for some time. A lot of people think of gold as having some absolute value. It doesn't have an absolute value. It's a market value, and there's a certain quantity of gold in the world. And there's a limit to how high the price of gold can go, because we can go and mine tailings from old gold mines and get a good gold out at a certain price. And once gold goes up above that price, then people start mining the tailings and putting more gold in the system and selling it, and the price goes back down again.
But, so that's the supply side. There's another thing in that not everyone wants to own a bunch of gold and have it in their house. So there's a demand side too.
Mm-hmm. So what we've got is gold has pretty much moved for the last year or so opposite the dollar. And by that, I mean, if the dollar goes up, gold goes down. If the dollar goes down, gold goes up. And the reason is the price of gold is pretty stable through the rest of the world right now. And if the price of gold is stable through the rest of the world, all that you're really seeing in the price of gold is the movement of the dollar. And if you think if the dollar, for example, continues up, and if interest rates continue up, in the United States, short-term rates continue up in the United States, odds are the dollar will continue to rise.
Right.
And if the dollar continues to rise, then we will see the price of gold continue to fall. A lot of people think gold is some kind of, as Jake said, some kind of inflation hedge. Actually, it's sort of the opposite, and it's losing more and more of the traditional characteristics with each passing year. Interestingly enough, throughout the world, and this is one of the things I find most ironic, gold is priced in dollars,
yeah,
literally everywhere in the world. In other words, the value of gold is based on the value of the dollar. Now, that should blow some people's minds who said, well, if the dollar collapsed, the gold would be very valuable. Actually,
it's priced in dollars, so it
would kind of shoot gold in the head, because nobody would have anything to buy it with. And if you can't, and nobody, if there's nothing left to buy, if the dollar were to collapse and there was nothing left to buy gold with, then the price of gold would collapse as well.
I have to tell you this. Gold doesn't have a head. You can't shoot it in the head. Just in case you were
the price of gold in the head.
Oh, the price might have a head. No, Nope, no head on the price.
Yeah, either. There is, too. It's called cap. It's called
capital.
Is head.
Yeah, capital means head. You're right. So you could shoot it in the capital.
You could shoot it in the capital, and it would work. As a matter of fact, you could make a gold target, put it in the capital, and shoot it. And you could only do it a couple of times before the police would arrest you for shooting it.
But right, and it would be very expensive to do that. I don't think that it'd be a good idea.
The other thing that's happening that... if you're interested in following these things and you're a geek like us, the Treasury yield is flattening. It continues to flatten. And what that means is if we go out to 30 years, the 30-year Treasury is trading at about 3% right now. And recently, the 10-year Treasury was 3.11%. So there was a few moments there where the Treasury yield from 10 years to 30 was flat. It's not now, because the Treasury yield has dropped back to 2.82%. 10-year Treasury yield has dropped back to 2.82%. But, and this is important, the short-term rate that the Fed charges to overnight rate back and forth is now up to about 2%.
3 minutes, stations. 3 minutes to your next
Fox News
30/30.
So what we have is a situation where the 2-year note and the 10-year Treasury are getting very, very, very close to each other, and we have a flattening yield curve. Now, historically, let's back up. If the Fed continues to raise short-term rates, which a lot of people expect them to do, they claim in their notes they're going to continue to do it, and they're going to continue to do it because now we've got wage inflation at 2.7%. Their target is 2% for inflation. If wage inflation continues at 2.7%, by definition, inflation will kick in at 2%. Now, the other thing is, there's no question that goods in the United States are getting more expensive because of tariffs. Very
right.
Simply, if something's made out of steel, it's going to cost more.
Something's out of aluminum, if it's a washing machine, if it doesn't matter if it's made elsewhere or here, the price went up.
So we got inflation. And there's no way that with the cost of things we're bringing in the United States going up and the cost of things in the United States going up that we're not going to get some inflation. Transportation restrictions are also pumping into inflation. So the Fed needs to get ahead of that. They need to raise short-term rates. Here's where the rub comes in. When short-term rates get higher than long-term rates, historically, we can say about 18 months later, we got a recession.
Let's give the reason for that, because it sounds like voodoo. If you just say there's a curve here. If interest rates at the bank, let's give an obscene number, are up at 10% for a CD.
For how long a CD?
For a 3-year CD.
Okay.
Okay, that's an absurd number. I'm using that as an example.
Hey, I remember when you could get 10% on a 3-year CD.
So a 3-year CD for 10%, and the market has gotten 5%. What you going to do? Well, you're going to sell out of the market and dump it into a CD, right? Yeah. There's no risk there. The bank's insured. So when short-term rates go up too high, it makes the risk of investing long-term money in an asset that has risk associated with it less attractive. You want to put it in a place that is low risk if you're going to get the high return. Well, what that does is it takes a lot of the money from expanding the economy to just saving.
Well, there's...
So you get growth dropping.
The yield curve inverting is part of that is in there, but the issue is that if short-term you think inflation's going to go to 5% next year.
Right.
So if you're going to loan your money...
Again, we don't think, but this is an example.
I know we don't think, but that's beside the point.
We don't think much at all. Go ahead.
If you think inflation is going to be 5%, you think inflation is going to be 3% for the next year, would you loan your money to somebody at 2.85%? Odds are you wouldn't. So if you believe that we're going to see higher inflation in the near term and you're going to loan your money even to the government, you'd want maybe a 4%, 3.5%, 4% return to compensate for inflation and taxes, even with a zero-risk loan to the government. On the other hand, if you look out at 30 years and you say, I think the economy is going to be slowing down after the next couple of years.
Or at least not growing as fast.
So that it's not doing that well. You're going to say what's going to happen is the demand for loans at longer term starts to fall off because people don't want to borrow money for long term when they think the economy is going to maybe go into recession, go backwards at some time in the next few years. So what we do is we see interest rates falling at the long term
and rising
at the short term. When we see that, it has been historically has been a very good predictor of recession. Now, why is that happening at present? Well,
it's not happening at present. It's just getting flatter. It's getting closer to that.
But what's happening is we're seeing long-term interest rates on corporate bonds and on treasuries not rising at all, while short-term rates are rising and the 10-year rate is now starting to fall. Why is that happening? One of the big reasons is, and they do this very secretively, is the Fed has a huge balance sheet. They have a huge quantity of bonds that they own, that they bought during the recession, and they're very slowly selling them into the market. And they, matter of fact, their minutes that they just released talked about the fact that they've got to get that balance sheet down so that in the term, when the next recession comes, they can go out and borrow some, take more money from the public, or give more money to the public by loaning them money.
Here's the danger with that, and this is, it's kind of an ironic danger, because the thing they're trying to prevent is they're trying to prevent not having the tools in place in the event of a recession.
But they could cause a recession in the process.
By trying to get their tools to prevent or to bring us out of a recession, they may cause a recession.
Yeah, it's kind of like there's been a flood and they pumped a bunch of water into this tank and now it's starting to dry out a little bit and they need to let the water back out again.
Don't let it all out at once, guys. Well, the thing you were trying to prevent happens again.
But it's happening, and it's not, they don't have total control, because it's also happening in Europe, and so it's happening around the world. So we've got this peculiar situation that we're faced with right now, and very frankly, we can't seem to get off the subject of tariffs no matter what we do.
It's a big part of the economy.
The Federal Reserve Act primarily tasks the Federal Reserve with two things. Number one is to maintain the stability of the dollar, which means prevent undue inflation. And number two, full employment. Full employment.
You missed one.
What's the other one?
Dodd-Frank said that they also have another mandate with very few tools to try to stabilize the stock market.
Right, but this is, I'm not talking about Dodd-Frank. I'm talking about the Federal Reserve Act itself.
Well, it was an amendment to the Federal Reserve Act in Dodd-Frank.
Well,
it's in there. They have now three federal mandates, and one of them is almost impossible.
So those first two are the ones that they primarily work on. They don't discuss that third one because nobody knows how to do that. But the point is that they have a mandate to hold inflation down. The tariffs and the tax cut are going to drive inflation up based on everything we know about history and about economics. Now, I will have to say that there is an opposing view on this. Secretary Mnuchin and Secretary Ross have both said that we can have a fast-growing economy, we can have tax cuts, and we can have tariffs, and it won't raise prices. I don't think that that's likely.
I would love that. I really would. Don't get me wrong. That would be fantastic. But it's never happened historically that way.
Well, I'm just, they have, they didn't.
I would love it.
Neither of them cited any reason why they believe that it wouldn't cause inflation to cut taxes and raise tariffs. But that's their, you know, they have the right to their opinion, and I wanted to state that it's out there. The point is, a lot of things are coming together, and all of those things that are coming together indicate again that we're somewhere near the top of a wonderful expansion.
Yes, and enjoy it while it's here. I realize we're being a bit pessimistic about the future. It's not really pessimistic to expect winter to come. Prepare for it. Downturns in the economy happen. You should prepare for it in the good times. We're in the good times. Next time we're in a good time, we'll have other things that lead to downtimes. We still have to prepare. All right, we have a caller on 773-1400. Caller, you are on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. I was going to ask you a question about money in a different situation here. Supposing you're going down the road and you get pulled over on a traffic stop, and in your vehicle, you have like about $45,000 cash in your vehicle, and they check you out and find out you have this much money. Then they ask you, what are you doing with all this money? Can you prove it's your money? And then if you don't have anything of evidence to prove that it's yours or anything else, they're liable to take it away from you. But it's legitimately your money. But I was
wait a minute, asking
me a question concerning that.
Sure. Why do you think they would take it away from you? Because they do.
Well, I was watching a show on television where they stopped this guy, and he had, I don't know, $30,000, $25,000, and they asked him all these weird questions, and he couldn't prove where he got it. He couldn't prove his check stub. He couldn't prove where he worked and everything else. And then finally they just confiscated his money, and it was just a question that I just was thinking about.
They have to suspect a crime, technically. So if they seize the asset, now there are different state laws. Kansas has laws that are a little bit more extreme than a lot of places, but this is really something to ask the Ask a Lawyer program. But the stuff that we can talk about is that you have recourse. They're not allowed to spend that money unless you're convicted of a crime that you were suspected of and that cash had to be involved with the crime or be part of a law that they say that they're allowed to keep the assets.
So you can go to court over it.
That's your recourse. They can take your cash if they believe that it's suspicious. Now, there's no probable cause needed. They just need suspicion. They can take the cash, and then you have to come back to them in court and prove that you had it correctly. I think there's a problem with that law, a very serious problem with that law, but we're not attorneys. I think this is one of the things where the state legislatures need to act, because this is not a federal issue. This is a state issue. The states say to their police officers, you're allowed to take this if you suspect it's involved in a crime. But they haven't given in many states, they haven't given the kind of guidelines on when that's appropriate.
Yes, sir. And I just wanted to ask you one more quick question so you can go on with your program. If you're remodeling a house and you're tearing down a wall or, you know, just making a bigger entrance to your house and you found, you know, a quite considerable amount of money, but, you know, old money, you know, from the 70s or 80s, can you go to the bank with a large amount of money like this and put it in your account without them asking you? You know, sure, money floats around like from 87, 88, a 5 or a 10 or a 20, but a big amount of money, would they ask you any questions? What are you doing with so much money from 30 years ago?
Okay. Good question. Yes, they're going to ask you money questions. When you take a bunch of cash to the bank anytime, they're going to ask you, where did this come from? You answer them truthfully and say, I found it in a wall in my house, and you pay income taxes on it as found money on your property. You will pay taxes on this, and it's yours. That's all good. If you say, I don't want to tell you, and then you don't pay your taxes on it, then you can go to jail.
Well, actually, you can say, I don't want to tell you, but you're still going to get anything over $10,000, the bank is going to notify.
The IRS is going to know.
That there's going to be a suspicious activity, and you do need to pay your taxes on it. And you're going to get some kind of investigation to make sure there wouldn't come to some kind of a drug deal. But people do.
Most people do. Don't buy drug deal money in 1970s dollars, though. So you've got some good stuff.
Yeah, but it's still, they may or may not note that they're 1970 dollars. They're just,
right.
They just note that it's money.
Yeah, one thing that may be important here is that there may be an investigation, and if they show up at your house and ask you questions, you need to answer them truthfully. If your house was built in the year 2003, there may be some further investigation because that could be stolen money.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that somebody put it in a wall and then forgot about it, if it's a large amount of money, somebody may have died, so it's got some amount of this is on the up and up, but it also could be that the prior owner of your house was a serial bank robber and he's been in prison and they knew about him, so don't expect to necessarily always keep it. Found money, even on your own property, could be stolen, so just be aware of that.
We probably need to break for commercials.
All right.
Do you actually have any commercials or just PSAs?
We've got some PSAs, but the online folks might be hearing something else. So we're going to play the PSAs, and we'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. If you'd like to join the phone, join us by phone, the phone number in here is 254-773-1400. We'll be back on the other side.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. Changing subjects a little bit, I would like to we got a caller on 773-1400?
We did. Hopefully they're still there through the break. So, sure. Caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach.
Go ahead, caller. You're on the air.
Maybe we're on hold.
Could be. All right.
If you're going to put us on hold, callers, just as a kind of good graces, if you're going to put us on hold, please have some hold music or some.
Yeah,
we prefer bagpipes.
Something.
So,
hey, there's a big issue going on in Lake Mead, and that is Lake Mead is down to a record low level. It's 150 feet below its normal pool level, and it's dropping. And finally, the state of Arizona has agreed to restrict its use of water from Lake Mead. There were two agencies in Arizona that controlled the water.
Most people may not know what Lake Mead is. Just think Hoover Dam. Most people do know what Hoover Dam is.
And the issue is that water from Lake Mead is what keeps California, Arizona, parts of even New Mexico, that part of the world runs on water. Las Vegas.
Yeah.
Runs on which the dam, Hoover Dam, which is near Las Vegas, runs basically without the water in Lake Mead, Las Vegas would be just a dried up desert hole. And the problem is that for the last 19 years, the snowfall melt has been below normal. And we have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Good morning, Jeff and Jake.
Good morning. It's the Flying Fox.
The famous Flying Fox.
The famous Flying Fox. The fabulous famous Flying Fox.
Listen, this may be what you might call a frivolous question, but
that's the only kind we take.
Okay, I'm getting tired of listening to this guy on television advertising to invest with him because you won't lose money when the stock market goes down. You don't go down, you go up, you never lose money. Mm-hmm. And I wonder how he gets by with that.
Because it's not a security.
If it's not regulated by securities laws, they're allowed to say whatever they want. If you think about gold advertisements, they can tell you, by the way, this is my precursor. This is false, but this is what they say. Gold's entering a bull market. You could see 40% rises. That is, while it's a possibility that gold will go up 40%, if somebody were to say that about the stock market and were involved in some way recommending to buy or selling securities, they would be in a lot of trouble.
How does this guy offer? If somebody calls him, and they're probably a little bit suspicious, and how does he offer them a confidence in what he's doing? Is he putting the money? What is it supposed to pay dividends, or
no,
how can a guy get by with it?
He's probably selling indexed annuities. It's either indexed life or indexed annuities, and basically, each year, the board of directors of an insurance company meets on an indexed annuity and says, and if it's in the indexed annuity, do so. Let's just say the stock market went up 10% for a given year. They have the ability to say, we'll give you 8%, we'll give you 8% more in the indexed annuity on paper because the stock market went up 10%. But if the stock market goes down, they can't lower that number. Now, here's the rub. When you buy that indexed annuity, they typically have a 15% surrender charge, and the surrender charge runs for 15 years. So you can't actually get the money out that they gave you
for a long time.
And the fine print in most of those is that money really isn't there if you ever decide to take it, because you can only get the full value that they said they've given you on paper if you annuitize it
at whatever interest rates they select, and they can annuitize it at a 0% interest rate for the rest of your life, or for 30 years, and say, we'll pay you, you know, if you've got all these gains in here, well, guess what? We will pay it out to you monthly at 0% interest over the next 30 years.
And here's a famous flying fox. You're going to enjoy this. Something that the SEC agrees about under Obama and under Trump is that equity-indexed annuities are bad.
Yes, and they have very high expenses. They pay very, very, very high commissions. And very frankly, I've looked at them and looked at the rates that they have been claiming and the rates that the boards of directors of insurance companies pay sometimes. And fundamentally, what they're saying is, we don't really expect to be in business in 15 years, so we'll take a lot of money out of this money. We'll give you numbers on paper that make it look like you're making a lot of money. And then 15 years from now or 10 years from now, when people start to want this money, we will have sold the contracts to some company that will then go out of business.
None of that is illegal, even though it sounds like it, because they're using the existing insurance law. And insurance companies go out of business. That's something that they have, you know, they have to be able to go out of business just like any other business. There is no protection for your assets beyond a co-insurance, and there are some state funds that do it, but they react very slowly and are unanimously underfunded.
The last time interest rates rose, which was back in the late 70s and the beginning of the 80s, which is the era that we're getting into now, there were a lot of insurance companies that failed that had made big promises. And I don't know if you remember the scandals. Prudential, for example, they didn't go out of business, was forbidden to sell insurance policies in the state of Texas for several years because they had promised these wonderful interest rates, and they'd shown these wonderful interest rates, but the fine print said, we don't have to give them to you, but we can just show them to you.
Just this lets you know how we think about it in the best possible way. If you're out there buying insurance and you come to us and say, is this a good rate on insurance? Should I buy this insurance? First we say, do you need insurance? We go through and then we look and say, yes, this is a competitive rate. You found a good one. If we find that insurance company also sells equity indexed annuities, we're going to say buy it from somebody else that may not be around.
There's a lot of complexities, but the big one is, if you look up, to give you the best example, there's something called, forgot it now, so not investors, it's something Life of California and of New York. I've forgotten the name, but there's also a company called Monarch. But there's several big companies that went out of business in the early 1980s, because interest rates went up and they made these promises. And as interest rates go up, their bond portfolio shrank. Investors Life of California, I think it was, and I may be wrong on that one. And Investors Life of New York. Only a couple of years ago did they finally close out those policies in court and finally say, no, there's no way these companies can be rehabilitated. And many of the holders of their annuities, which included retirement annuities.
Executive life.
Executive Life of California, one of the biggest back in the early 80s.
91.
Started downhill. In 1990, it went belly up. And it was only a couple of years ago that the courts finally liquidated the company, and they gave about a third of what people had initially invested in these annuities back to them. Now, in some states, I don't think it would have worked in Texas, the state insurance guarantee fund made them whole for the total dollar amount they put in, but this was after 30 years. 20 or 30 years of not having any money coming from these things. So it isn't anything that's too good to be true is generally speaking too good to be true.
Right. What led to the failure of Executive Life and three other very large insurance companies at the time was something called interest-sensitive products and guaranteed investment contracts.
Yeah, and which is basically what you're talking about, a guaranteed investment contract.
That's exactly what we're talking about today. It's got a different name.
So,
well, I'm glad to get all that information.
I hope your other listeners are as pleased as I am, because, see, I've been watching that guy on TV, and I've decided he was probably a sissy anyway.
That's a reasonable...
He looks like a sissy to me. You know?
I don't know whether he was a sissy or not, but I will say this. Anytime you give money, and this is something we tell people who want to buy a fixed annuity. If you give a company a fixed annuity with no ability to get the money out without taking a big hit for many, many years, let's say you're planning on it lasting for 30 years, you're making a bet that that company will remain financially responsible and strong for 30 years, a single company. Now, if somebody told you we want you to put your entire retirement in a bond or in a stock of a single company for 30 years, any reasonable person would say, how do we know that company won't encounter some difficulty and go bankrupt along the way? And the answer is, you don't know. But people still buy these annuities and think they're perfectly safe because they're guaranteed. But the annuity business and the life insurance business is the only major financial institution that's not backed by any form of federal insurance at this point.
Well, you brought up another good question there, Jeff. You know, I retired from Exxon.
Mm-hmm.
And my retirement was in the form of an annuity that they bought from an insurance company.
Right.
And so I'm wondering now, I can't recall right off the air whether it was Prudential or somebody else, mm-hmm. where they bought this policy. Now, what recourse, I keep on living and this company goes out of business, I wonder if Exxon has any backup for that.
No. They wouldn't.
This is the same thing that General Motors went through during its bankruptcy, is that they had to sell a bunch of their annuities off to companies, the pension annuities off to life insurance companies. And if any of those life insurance companies fail, it's not the responsibility of the selling party anymore. They don't have any.
Yeah. And in a situation like you're discussing, it's called a group annuity. Those are not covered by the state insurance guarantee funds in most cases. Probably the company you've got it with is financially secure right now. We've had 30 years of falling interest rates, so that makes it really good. It took 10 years of rising interest rates to make those big companies start going out of business, and we could easily be seeing 10 years of rising interest rates going forward. So I would expect another wave of insurance companies to fail about 10 years from now. And it's going to be the ones that are pushing the guaranteed rates today.
Well, if my insurance company lasts another 10 years, I ought to be in good shape.
Yeah, and you've got one, and whatever it is, you might want to take a look at it. They probably don't sell indexed annuities.
No, they don't.
So you're probably in pretty good shape.
All right. Well, I just you guys did a good job of answering my question there. I didn't mean to be facetious because that guy gets on my nerve.
Well, don't listen to him anymore. Turn the TV off.
This is something we're about out of time. But this is something when I was in middle school, I had a teacher teaching theater, and she brought in a medical catalog from the 1800s. And we flipped through it, and everybody laughed about all the promises and claims about how they could claim to do anything for you. And at that point, the FDA was still involved in regulating vitamins. Well, they're not involved in regulating vitamins anymore, and you see exactly the same stuff. What you see in unregulated sales practices is what you would expect to see in unregulated sales practices. People are going to tell you what they think that you want to hear so that you will buy from them.
Particularly when they pay really high commissions.
Yeah.
Okay. Bye-bye.
All right. Thanks for the call.
And you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach. We're about out of time for the second hour, and that's going to be the end of our radio broadcast for July 7th. The Personal Wealth Coach is not just the name of the program. It's not that the two bald guys in here also manage investments. And if you want to give us a call off the air, we have voicemail on weekends, and we have live people during the week at 254-947-1111.
Or 1-800-914-7526. That's
914 plan.
You can reach us, Jeff at tpwc.com or Jake at tpwc.com. Until next week, this has been the Personal Wealth Coach.